CliffCentral.com.
Quite a figile.
But now, why are you not singing? I don't understand.
I couldn't follow. Said something like "Kanti quite a figile," something like that.
But you know what figile means? Can't you follow from there?
Why don't you follow?
No, that's not my gig.
You're pushing me
gig.
Into a corner here. What's your problem?
It's just that people have wanted to hear you sing for many weeks now.
It's been a while.
It's been a while. They're missing you. They want you to sing.
Yeah, no. Tune in next week.
This guy's all about promises. Under delivery, over promising. Wow.
Well, in line with our topic today, maybe.
Sanbunan Nogi, welcome to the show. It's Frankly Speaking. Rory Sung and Andrew Levy back in the saddles. We've been away for a little bit. Planning, thinking, doing.
Yeah, mostly
doing nothing.
Not thinking though. That comes difficult, eh?
What have you been up to?
Nah, this and that. Here and there.
You know when people say that, you know it's dodgy. This guy, you know, like when they talk about political party trails, it's no wonder this is now what we're doing for the next few weeks. We're talking about politicking. I wonder what this guy's doing in the background.
I've perfected my laugh.
Yeah, I wonder what's happening in the background here.
I have perfected my laugh. That's what I've been doing. But let's get on with it, Andrew.
Talk to me. What's happening?
So, a lot's been happening. We're back. We tend to look at the hot potato issues, ask the questions that everybody seems to find difficult to ask.
So, we should be asking about Buhle Mkize and Gigabyte.
Please, spare us. The
slideshows, dude.
Spare us the train smash on that one. But a more significant thing has been happening, of course. There is the ANC election campaign. So in December, the ANC chooses its new leader. Mm-hmm. And it will definitely not be Jacob Zuma. Mm-hmm. As things stand, I mean, this is a crazy world we live in.
Well, that's one positive, right? That he's not trying to stand for a third term.
You don't know yet. You don't know yet. And he might decide, rather than stand, just take a third term. Mm-hmm. You know, these things happen on this continent. But so one of the front runners, of course, in that race is his former wife, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma.
Be careful,
to
please.
You.
Please just be careful about that.
Because as a journalist
She's
found
earned
out,
that name. She's
as
earned
a journalist found out recently, you don't just call her Mrs. Dlamini Zuma or Mrs. Zuma. She is doctor. She worked hard for that title. Mm-hmm. She's one of the front runners, and we thought, you know what? Let's have a look at this. She's just come back from the AU, and you don't really see a lot, at least in the South African media, around her time at the AU. Mm. So it was we thought it might be a useful opportunity for us to ask, in our typically provocative way, is Africa's garbage South Africa's treasure? Mm. She left under what seems to be, if you read all the reports and so on, she didn't get glowing commendations for her time at the AU after serving just one term. So it might be it's interesting to then see that this person that the rest of the continent has rejected essentially is now being positioned to become the leader of our country. Mm. So in that sense, we ask: is Africa's garbage South Africa's treasure?
I'm fascinated by this because Dr. Dlamini Zuma has filled many roles in her lifetime. She's a doctor, she's an activist, she was an academic at stages. She then filled roles in ministries throughout our democratic governments. So that's very important to realize. From Nelson Mandela,
right throughout,
Thabo Mbeki, Helen Mkhlanthe,
she's been a minister all through our democratic era.
And Mr. Zuma himself. Mm. So she's been there for a while. She's very involved in the Women's League. She seems to have the support of the Young Lions as well, the ANC Youth League. And to be honest and fair, I didn't know a lot about her. You read the headlines, you hear the reports, you hear the journalist snippets, and you're like, well, okay, that's fantastic. But didn't really go into depth about who this woman was. And upon reading the last few nights just about who this woman is and her career, I actually got quite afraid. I got quite fearful. She said in a report in The Star on Monday that you know, she's not here because of someone's so-and-so's name, right? She's here on her own accord. And I truly do believe that. But there is this discomforting feeling that when you're married to someone for 20-odd years, you build a life together, you build businesses together, you build ties together. Those don't disappear when you divorce.
Yeah, but I don't know, man. I mean, how many leaders have been divorced or have ex-girlfriends, ex-boyfriends? We've got a minister of finance that can't seem to get rid of his ex-girlfriends. I don't see it as a big issue.
The big issue is, are these interests aligned? You know, I truly believe that she might even have good intention not to be just the fall person for Zuma and keep Zuma Inc. going. But I do wonder if her interests are aligned with Zuma's so much
well,
so that
she'll protect
him.
They've got four kids together, right? And in some of the corridors and in the grapevine, I've heard that she was initially slated to be part of the, I think, Mbeki slate in Polokwane, and she withdrew. And the primary reason for her withdrawal was that, you know, Zuma is the father to my kids. How do I run against him? How do I, you know, how do I go into this very dirty fight against him when at the end of the day I must still share the responsibilities of parenting with him. So there is a very real, and of course we've heard recently reports that she spends time at Ngandla, and with some people raising the question, is she really an ex-wife? And I think I read somewhere around that time that in African culture, in African tradition, there's no such thing as an ex-wife. So there is definitely merit in the idea that there are shared things, least of all just being the fact that they are parents together. So and that would then also then, you know, imply a certain loyalty to Zuma. And of course this is a big issue going into the next election, because the commonly believed thought around this is that Zuma needs to have somebody handpicked to take over the presidency, because whoever comes in next would have the power to make sure that the charges that he hasn't yet stood for, he ultimately stands for. And it's interesting that Kozana Dlamini Zuma is seen as that person.
What fascinates me is she seems to be going quite hard on the fact that she's a woman, and that the patriarchal society is, you know, she's going to fight against it, and that she's, you know, on her Twitter account, she actually says she's a gender activist. Nomboniso Gasa, who's been a guest on the show before, had a very interesting Twitter debate about how gender activist are you really. And she cites two really interesting moments. The first is obviously the Kwezi affair, which we know about regarding the accusations, I suppose, at this stage, of the alleged rape of Mr. Zuma with Kwezi, and apparently Kwezi is a friend of the family. Kwezi would have indicated that she would have said Zuma is uncle, or referred to her as uncle. So they were close, is what I'm saying. She kept very silent on that. And another one, which is more important, was when Dlamini Zuma was Minister of Foreign Affairs, Norman Mashabane was accused of sexual harassment. And this wasn't an idle accusation. And apparently Dlamini Zuma backed Mashabane and ignored evidence presented to her. She shunned advice, including from her DG at the time, which was Sipho Phatyana. So there's, you know, and in her AU chain, we'll speak to Simon Allison, and he's the Africa editor at the Mail and Guardian, about her tenure at the AU. I mean, one of the biggest issues is South Sudan, where they're using gang rape as a method of warfare there. She was totally silent on it, has been quiet on it. So this kind of thing of her being a woman, what are your feelings on that?
There is an interesting question here. So first of all, We can judge her on the basis of being a woman and not doing enough for women issues.
Mm.
But then we can judge her as a leader in relation to other leaders. So which other leaders have raised the mantle, right? So here we are talking about punishing a woman for not standing up for women issues.
Mm.
We're not punishing men for not standing up for women issues either. So that's an interesting thing to look at.
We're not punishing her because she's a woman. We're punishing her because she self-entitles herself as a gender activist.
She labels herself as a gender activist.
Yeah.
Well,
so that's a different story.
Well, it's something worth looking into, because if you look at the reports, I mean, Simon will be here shortly, and he'll give us. He says in his article on her time at the African Union that one of the good things that she did was to bring gender parity, or at least push for it within that environment, and to the extent that and sounds like she was successful on a number of fronts. So she has done some. She probably hasn't succeeded completely, but hey, you know, let's judge her on her merits, and that's the whole point we're having this discussion, to say, well, if she failed so dismally, as some say, at the African Union, what hope do we have in South Africa that she's going to be this amazing person?
How does her track record stand up? On the line is the African editor at the Mail and Guardian, Mr. Simon Allison. Simon, good morning to you. Thank you for taking some time out to chat to us today. We're looking at Nkosana Dlamini Zuma. Is Africa's garbage South Africa's treasure? And we wanted to, you wrote an article a little while ago about this, and wanted to get your buy-in. Just give us your thoughts about Dlamini Zuma's tenure at the African Union.
Good morning. Well, you know, when she left the African Union, I thought it was time to really write a sort of wrap of how she'd done and consult a whole range of diplomats and civil society and people who'd worked with her. And just to get a real sense of what her term was like, because, you know, there are these conflicting narratives. Some people say she was terrible. Other people, like the ANC Women's League, hail her time at the AU as a roaring success. So what is the truth? And to be honest, I was quite taken aback with the kind of responses I got, which were overwhelmingly negative. The negative perceptions of her focused on a couple of different issues. The first issue, and this came up very prominently, is that Madame Dlamini Zuma was very insular, that she surrounded herself with a very tightly knit team of South Africans that she brought into Addis Ababa, and she really refused to engage very much beyond that. Even ambassadors to the African Union had to wait a couple of months before they could get an appointment to see her, whereas her predecessor, Jean Ping, he'd had an open-door policy that anyone could come and see him at any time. So that really didn't count in their favor much. You know, at one point in Addis, there was a joke going around that they only serve pup in the canteens now because of that perception of a bias towards South Africa from her. A second issue that was really important and really affected her ability to do her job was the way in which she was elected. So the election for African Union chairperson, which she eventually won, was really bitter and acrimonious, and South Africa really had to use all its diplomatic might to bully African nations into voting for her.
Were there brown envelopes there, Simon? Is that what you mean by all of our diplomatic might? Are you speaking about brown envelopes?
That's absolutely not what I'm saying, and there is no proof for that whatsoever. What I'm saying is, you know, South Africa is an influential diplomatic force on the continent, and, you know, I think we pulled a lot of strings to try and get her into her position.
Simon.
Yeah.
I just want to dig into this issue of just how awkwardly she came in. Of course, there was a gentleman's agreement prior to her being voted in that basically said that the large economic powers on the continent don't contest the AU chair, and South Africa, in its wisdom, decided to break that gentleman's agreement, and that caused a lot of disunity. How did that impact her ability to at least fulfill the mandate for which she was supposedly then voted for? I mean, she went in on a divided mandate from the beginning.
Exactly. And really, you saw this a lot it's a very simplistic way of looking at things, but there is this divide in the African Union, broadly speaking, between Anglophone countries and Francophone countries. And, you know, South Africa was kind of able to repair its relationship with the Anglophone countries to a large extent, but really not the Francophone countries and not, most importantly, Nigeria. So you had this large block of countries that was quite resistant to anything that she wanted to do because they saw it as a, you know, they were looking at the situation being like, why has South Africa put so much time and effort into getting her into this job? It must be because South Africa wants to, you know, extend its sort of neo-colonial agenda on the African continent through the AU. So we must therefore be on high alert to stop South Africa from trying to take over the continent. Because she was seen as a sort of stalking horse for South Africa's own continental ambition. And whether that was true or not, and I have my doubts, but I don't think that that was the motivation for her appointment or for her being sent there by Jacob Zuma. I think
what,
that probably,
what do you think was the motivation?
I suspect it had a lot more to do with domestic politics, personally. Mm. You know, that always has been President Zuma's far greater concern. And you know, the proof is in the pudding, really. And if this really had been about furthering South Africa's interests, well, the end result is it has not furthered South Africa's interests. It really has set them back. Mm. And I think anyone with a rudimentary understanding of foreign policy back in 2012 would have understood that, would have known what the consequences were. So I don't think that was what Zuma was trying to achieve. I think he was probably trying to keep Lamini Zuma out of the South African fray, out of the messy cut and thrust of domestic politics, so that she can indeed come back 4 years later with a relatively clean reputation on the national front.
I want us to talk in a bit about how she seems to be characterized as this passive, and I don't know whether it's because she's a woman or it's just because of who she is. She just seems to be this passive actor in the machinations of Jacob Zuma, of South Africa, and so on. And even her responses, you know, when they ask, you know, are you, how do you feel about being moved from being a minister to going to the AU? Her response is constantly, oh, I do as the ANC pleases, basically. Mm. This is supposed to be a very smart woman who has achieved a lot. So that's quite disconcerting. But before we get there, Simon, I just want to, it wasn't unreasonable though for South Africa to push her to be the president, right? To be the chair. She had done what many thought was a great job as a South African minister. Right from the time of Mandela, she was the Minister of Health, she was the Minister of Foreign Affairs under Mbeki, and then she became the Minister of Home Affairs under the Zuma administration. So it wasn't unreasonable, was it, to put her forward?
No, look, I think we can all agree that she certainly was qualified for the job. She had the right kind of background. She certainly had plenty of connections in Addis and across the African continent from her time as Foreign Affairs Minister. But that really wasn't the point. The point was, as you mentioned earlier, you know, breaking that gentleman's agreement and putting her in that position really meant that she, you know, even with the best intentions in the world and the best qualifications in the world, I think that she would have struggled to really make a success of this position. And I don't think we can give her the sort of best intentions in the world. I think that's probably a little too generous.
Simon, there's a lot of criticism of the AU generally. It's hard to distinguish what was her fault and what is the AU as an organization's fault. But let's just look at some issues across the continent that she was the silence was deafening. I mean, go from Chibok Girls, Ebola, South Sudan, Somalia. There seems to be a huge amount of just let's keep. It feels like Marikana with Lonman all over again. There's a huge crisis. Everyone's going ballistic about it, and yet here is the leader going.
And she was accused for being aloof. So,
I mean, what are your thoughts? Is it her fault, or is it a situation of the AU is absolutely useless, and that was part of the problem?
Look, I think she really had a difficult position, and we have to distinguish between what she could actually do and what really was outside her realm of competence. So the things that she could do were things like reforming the commission itself, you know, And she did a little bit of that in terms of like getting rid of the dead word, trying to appoint new people, but she didn't do that very well. And that's really a big failing. In terms of the big peace and security issues, she was really hamstrung by, the African Union itself, because it is a combination of member states. They have to vote on these big issues, and really the will to tackle these issues head on was not present. At one point in her tenure, I think it was in 2014 or 2015, when the Burundi crisis was kicking off, she came out very strongly and said, no, the Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza should not stand for a third term, and the AU did not endorse this, and would be taking action. And that was hailed as quite a pivotal moment of the AU actually, for once waking up and trying to do something. But at the very next African Union summit, which was in January 2016, she received a pretty firm rap on the knuckles from the Peace and Security Council of the AU, which sort of said, no, that's not the stance that we're going for at all. And I think that sort of burned her a little. So, it took her a good few years to work up the courage to try and take a bit of her own initiative on these big peace and security issues. And as soon as she did, she got into trouble.
Simon, you've written about another notable woman leader on the continent, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the president of Liberia, and now, and how she came in on a wave of optimism and so on, and now it looks like her legacy is in tatters. We have almost a similar sense of Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma walking into the AU chair, in spite of the mess in which she came in, coming in on the wave of being a very successful and effective minister, and coming out of that role with mixed emotions, and now she's being positioned for the role of president of South Africa by being president of the ANC. Is there something here about women leadership? I know it's a provocative question.
Oh,
but
my word.
You look at these things.
Oh, Rory.
Wait, I'm worried about this, Rory.
Where's this going?
Hey, just bear with me. Is there something here about the ability of institutions on the continent to be led by women? So not so much that these women come in and they're very well, they've achieved a lot, they have good credentials and so on, but the institutions themselves seem to be unable to be changed. Does this have anything to do with the fact that we can look at her and say her time at the AU was horrible, and point fingers at her, but ultimately it's because she was really fighting against a patriarchal system that has that basically was set against her right from the beginning?
Look, that certainly plays a role, and I think that Dlamini Zuma knew this going in, and her the one really bright spot of her chairmanship was the way in which she championed gender and really tried to push greater female representation at the very top levels of African diplomacy. Quite a few of the positions that remain unfilled in the African Union are because she was presented with a list of candidates that included absolutely no women, and she refused to even consider shortlists that did not have female candidates on them. So just the mere fact of being a woman and bringing women's issues onto the very highest table at the African Union, I think that was a success, and that hopefully has changed the way the institution conducts its business going forward.
I think we can't ignore the fact that on the African continent there is a lot of patriarchy in all systems, in all spheres. But I think if you do your job properly, it doesn't matter if you're a man or woman, and no one looks at you at the end of the day and goes, "Oh no, she's a woman." If you lead correctly, if you provide a voice to the voiceless in the right way, I mean, it doesn't matter.
What
right?
happened to you in the 2 weeks that we were off air? You sounded like a DA person.
No,
if you lead properly, it doesn't matter if you're black or white. Yes, it's just if you just just leave.
No. Let me give
it's
you
not
examples,
because
right?
you're bla- it's not
so
because
Simon
you're
is telling us about how she wanted more roles for females in the AU, which I agree on. She often threw it back if there weren't enough candidates, right? But for example, with South Sudan, she said nothing, right? This is where gang rape is going on all the time. This is where journalists have to take rape kits into it. This is where aid workers get raped all the time. She says absolutely nothing, right? In Burundi,
but Andrew, that has nothing to do with her gender.
Exactly. This is where she could have taken a good stand, right? It doesn't have to, it has nothing to do with her gender. She should have been able to be quite.
No,
she should have been able to be a leader.
As I explained earlier, there are constraints within the African Union itself, and that would apply to any chairperson.
Well, help me understand that.
Well, just as explained, the actual commission, the way the AU is structured, is there is the African Union itself, which is the member state, and they vote on issues. The African Union Commission, of which, of course, Zanele Dlamini Zuma was the chairperson, purely exists to enforce the will of the AU itself.
So it's more of a she had a secretariat type of role.
She is not and has never been chairperson of the African Union. She has been chairperson of the African Union Commission. And it's two very different things.
So she can only pronounce on what the African Union what the African Union
delivers on.
Says. So if the African Union is silent, she can't then come and
exactly.
say something.
Exactly. And when she tried to do that over Burundi as the main example, she really got firmly battered down.
That's very useful to know because, we can get swept up in this cloud of criticism about her. The topic of this show, of course, is Africa's garbage, South Africa's treasure. She hasn't had a very glowing, or at least let's call it the conventional wisdom, hasn't been glowing about her time at the commission. What would your answer be to that question? Is South Africa here trying to shine a turd, as it
My ultimate conclusion is that Dlamini Zuma was a moderately good manager of the African Union. She was okay. She got things done. There was a basic level of efficiency. She was not an exceptional leader. She didn't have it within herself to push the boundaries of her role or to sort of turn the institution into towards another path. And of course, that wasn't necessarily her role, but I do imagine that somebody else may have been able to do more than she did. So I think that's what South Africa should be asking ourselves for our next potential leader. Do we need an exceptional leader or do we need a moderately good manager?
Simon, before we let you go, one last thing about her, I suppose, her tenure at the AU, being the chairperson. She introduced the Agenda 2063. She gave a State of the Continent address in the most important political city in Africa, which was Durban. The Economist said it quite nicely and said her flagship policy, Agenda 2063, is like a balloon ride over the Serengeti, offering pleasant views of a distant horizon and powered by hot air. Your thoughts on that Agenda 2063 and whether it's actually worthwhile and implementable, or is it just a whole bunch of, as the Economist said, hot air?
I tend to agree with the Economist. The African Union, if you look at the policies of the African Union, they are phenomenally good by and large, really progressive, really forward-thinking. The only problem is those policies are almost never implemented, and that is really the big gap. So I think Agenda 2063 fits into that. The nice wall of shiny policies that the AU has that at the moment aren't looking like going to be implemented anytime soon.
Simon, just one last question. I know Andrew said last, but you know how it is in these studios.
You always gotta have the last.
It's always great, or at least the big test of leadership is not when she is there, but what happens after she has left, and whether some of the good things that she has done are going to remain in place, whether things will accelerate when she's not there, or whether they'll slow down, which will give us an indication of the space that she occupied, and how she occupied it. Post Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, what is your assessment of what will happen to the AU Commission? Do you think that things are going to get better there, or do you think think that she played a significant enough role that she's going to be missed?
I don't think she'll be missed. I think that her successor is going to be, keep the ship sailing in the same direction and probably with a lot less friction. But what is important for the future of the AU itself is they are currently debating, and it should be decided on at the next summit, which I think is in June or July this year, a whole bunch of reforms as to how the AU operates. And these reforms are going to try and make it a more streamlined, more responsive, more reactive institution, just to try and get it, to actually be doing a better job of leading the continent. And if those reforms are successful, that is going to change the future of the AU.
Simon Allison, African editor for the Mail and Guardian, thank you very much for your time. We look forward to talking to you again about issues on the African continent. We appreciate you talking about Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One of the interesting things, Rory, about the Agenda 2063, which I loved when reading the document, and I didn't read all of it because I just couldn't, was one of the points that NDZ made was that by 2020, all wars on the African continent will be ceased, will stop, will cease to exist. No plan whatsoever on how to do that. I feel like
you're coming into this conversation and we didn't ask.
We didn't ask the
typical question at the beginning of the show, like how are you coming into this conversation? Yeah, but you're like completely opposed to her. Your questions are very anti NDZ. What's going on inside of you about her?
That's a great question. I'm not really sure at the moment because here's the conundrum that is Dr. Dlamini-Zuma. We look at Home Affairs, and it might have been that she had an amazing DG under her, but Home Affairs was turned around, right? Mm. Fantastic. Mm. We look at the health ministry that she looked after for so long, and it becomes very scary. She promoted a thing called Viridine, which at the time of HIV/AIDS, when it was at its climax, was actually a toxic industrial solvent. She pioneered it and was the big proponent of it, and actually it as a miracle cure for AIDS, and it was complete and utter rubbish. Mm. If that went through, millions of people would have died by using this toxic industrial. Mm-hmm. It's like using cleaning liquid for HIV/AIDS victims. Mm. People with HIV/AIDS. Mm. So then we turn our attention to the AU, and again, just reading the headlines, Dlamini-Zuma's entire tenure there was characterized for me by two things. One, everyone disliked her. Mm. She was never in Ethiopia and Addis, and we've both been to Addis, luckily enough. Mm. It's a nice enough city. There's no reason not to be there. The food's good.
We occupied we were in a single...
five-star...
let's not even go there because but the question, though, is...
So I'm untrusting is how I'm coming into this thing. She hasn't proven to me in any way that she is the person that should
turn around
this country.
So your answer is that South Africa is indeed taking Africa's garbage and trying to turn it into its treasure. Is that what you're coming into this conversation?
That's very loaded. That's very loaded.
We aren't the politically correct type, so just give me an answer.
I think we're in trouble. And we should speak to someone who knows much better than I do, because I'm, again, going in hearsay and feelings. You know me and feelings, right?
Yeah.
Richard Poplack is an incredible South African journalist. He often terms himself as the turd that sits in journalism. Richard, good morning to you. You've been following Dr. Dlamini-Zuma around on her non-roadshow. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing good. How are you guys?
So how's we're good. How's the non-road show going at the moment?
Well, I haven't spent much time with her in the past couple of weeks, but the trip that I did take with her, was significantly revealing, especially considering the fact that we didn't know much about what her policy outlook would be at the time. She returned from the African Union as something of a political cipher. Now we know much, much more about her. And let's just say that listening to her speak is always unpleasant.
Tell us more.
Just take a moment for that line. Okay.
Yeah.
What's so unpleasant about a doctor, an esteemed person, the former AU chair, commission chair, speaking? How dare you, man?
Former Home Affairs Minister, struggle stalwart.
Where do you come off saying that it's unpleasant for her to speak? What is it that's so unpleasant?
Yeah, that's Tuesday. It's all about chutzpah.
She lacks that thing, as Claudie would say. That thing.
Yeah, she does not have that thing. But what she does have is a whole bunch of buzzwords that don't really mean much. We don't understand what radical economic transformation is at this point. We don't understand what that means in policy terms. We certainly don't understand the other buzzwords that she tends to use. So really, most of what she speaks about are these sort of Zuma-like policy positions that no one really gets or understands. So that's kind of the situation that we're at right now. And it's dangerous in the sense that I have no idea what kind of government this woman would run.
Richard, you're a very opinionated guy, which is why we love you so much. Before you started going on the road with her in the earlier days, the AU and so on, what were your feelings towards her, just based on your circles and hearsay that came up? What were your feelings about this human?
Well, the interesting thing is that I was actually at the AU when the South African government was trying to shove her through as the chairperson.
Right.
And what was so revealing about that particular sort of gambit, it was clear that what the ANC in particular were trying to do was get her out of the way while all of the shenanigans here were happening, get her off to a sort of esteemed position that would mean that she's not caught up in the sort of local government shenanigans. And other African countries and governments and ambassadors and diplomats were extremely upset by what the South African government was trying to do over there in Addis Ababa. So that was sort of my first introduction to her as a sort of a major player. And she was very quiet. There was no real understanding of who she was, what she would do at the African Union. There was no suggestion that she had any new ideas or anything like that. And, you know, it was just impossible to know what she was thinking. And that sort of carried through into at least the first few weeks after she arrived here back in South Africa. I had no idea who the lady was.
I mean,
she was just kind of like a blank shadow.
This is almost as good as House of Cards. And I'll tell you why, Rory and Richard. Like, this just shows the brilliance behind Zuma Inc. is just absolutely brilliant. They saw a storm coming. They saw a storm coming. They knew there was going to be a whole bunch of rubbish. They knew there were going to be gates coming out of all sorts of spheres. So what do? They send their queen, typically their queen, away just to, you know, so she's still got credibility and can still hold the fort to come back in the storm with a perfect record, not involved in any of this local rubbish, but still then control most of it going forward. Unbelievable!
But guys, I need to, on that, Richard, maybe you can give some insight. I'm intrigued by this thing that, you know, she keeps saying, she's said recently as well, that she is a leader and she's a person in her own right. You shouldn't judge her on the basis of her surname and who she was married to. She claimed her title recently when somebody just called her Mrs. Zuma and she said, I am a doctor, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. I worked hard for that title and you should refer me by that title. So I see that character, right? And then I hear such statements that put her as the object in sentences, not the subject. She was sent away to remove her from the local, from the domestic thing.
Wants,
she does as the ANC pleases. She seems to be, you know, she's not on a political campaign. She's just being invited to come and speak at all of these different places.
Yeah.
How do these two characters reconcile? Like, I'm struggling to understand how this person who affirms her identity and independence on the one hand can be characterized as such an object to be used at the will and the pleasure of, amongst others, Jacob Zuma. How does that work?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right, and it's one of the confounding things about so many of our leaders here in South Africa. Many of them were incredibly courageous back in the fighting against apartheid. Here you have a black woman who somehow managed to, A, you know, resolutely fight against the previous regime and somehow earn a medical doctorship in the process. So this is an incredible person, objectively speaking, right? At the same time, the stuff that she's done inside government has not been good, and she has to stand by her record. Mm. Second of all, the fact that she was married to Jacob Zuma, they have four children and probably share a number of assets, is not something we can take out of the equation. It needs to be questioned. The closeness of their current relationship needs to be questioned. So the weird thing is that we always have to do this bizarre dissociative process between the Jacob Zuma who existed prior to becoming president, or at least during the struggle, and the guy who runs the country now. And it's this weird toggle that we keep having to make, and it's probably one of the most upsetting things about writing about these people, is that, you know, it's this constant question of what happened to you.
What do you think happened?
You know, I think power is a terrible thing, and I think we don't quite yet understand the psychology of power, and the kind of hubris syndrome that takes over once people gain it. You know, right out of the gate, one of the first scandals, even before the arms deal, this was the Sarafina 2 debacle. Mm. The person involved in that was Khosasana Dlamini Zuma. You know, so going right back to one of, you know, Democratic South Africa's original sins, if we're looking around for personalities, there we find the woman who wants to be the president of the country.
But guys, you guys are sounding, and I need to take this because I feel like everybody is just anti-NDZ at the moment. You're sounding like haters. How, you know, is there anyone, is morality a useful measure, yardstick of politicians, considering that there are actually none that have any morals? So it almost becomes an offset type of situation.
Mm-hmm.
On other issues, has she not proven herself at least to be? I think you're the one that said that she is. You know, her versus Balekembete might have been the best of the worst choices.
Mm-hmm.
What is it specifically that you have against her, apart from the fact that she was married to Jacob Zuma and shares kids assets with her?
It's got, you know, the dynasty issue is an issue, but that's not it.
Mm.
What it comes down to is A, her record, right, which is spotty at best. She, you know, home affairs, she did quite well. But when it comes to the African Union, we have some of the issues that have been very obvious in the couple of months that she's been here. An imperiousness, a lack of understanding of democratic processes, the fact that she wouldn't give meetings even to African ambassadors. And we need to keep in mind that the European Union and other outside governments pay for about 78% of the African Union government, of the African Union budget. She would not meet with those people. So, and the fact that she didn't really get anything done at the African Union. All of that stuff is immensely concerning. When we add into the mix the statements that she's made over the course of the past 3 or 4 months, which have showed her to be resolutely within the let's call it the Jacob Zuma faction of the ANC, all of that is concerning, right? Throw in the dynasty issue. And throw in the fact that she's a hell of a boring to listen to. You know, what am I supposed to be doing? Standing up and cheering? You know, it's just it's not possible.
And
listen, you know, when it comes to that morality issue, you're 100% right. All of these people ultimately didn't become politicians because they want to, you know, because they love hugging children.
Exactly.
They're tough people, but we have to judge them on their record. That's all.
I wanna go back to the dynasty issue, Rory, that you don't want to talk about here for a second. And Richie, you spoke about her link to number one. You know, what do we know of many ties to Atul and AJ? Given that they really are number one, you know, let's be honest here.
With regard to the Gupta's, we know there's some sort of tangential ties. We know that there is something of a relationship there. We know that the ANN 7 and the New Age have an award, believe it or not, called the South African of the Year Award, the SATI, I think it's SATI or something. And last year they gave that in a big ceremony that was televised on ANN 7. They gave the award to Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma.
No, but I mean, she deserved it. I mean, look, let's see who she beat. I mean, she beat Bonang. She beat ex-CEO Brian Malefe. She beat the brilliant Sheikh Mashaba. His coaching career there in Bafana has been amazing. And I don't know how she beat, to be honest. Here's the kicker for me. I do not know how she beat Miss World 2014, Rolien Strauss. I mean, I have no idea. That woman is amazing.
So you
she should have been
saying?
South African of the Year.
You guys are ridiculous.
I mean, I think Sheikh won a game last year. And so it's just
allegedly,
not
allegedly.
Really
but guys,
go ahead. No, I just, what was interesting to me is I wrote a piece about the statues or statues or whatever they're called. And, I've never been as heavily trolled by the Gupta camp. And this was before the sort of institution of their proper paid Twitter campaign. It was actually Atul himself who was trolling me along with Pinky and a couple of the other, I actually made the front page of the New Age.
Oh, wow.
Pinky wrote an editorial about how terrible I am. For which I'm grateful.
But, guys, help me understand, Rich, you particularly, she was used again as an object, and she was imposed on the African Union Commission as chair, and whereas she was supposed to bring unity and harmony and forward movement, she brought disunity just by her presence. She is now being used to, as an object again, to try and bring unity and harmony and forward movement in a very divided ANC, and then by implication to South Africa. How does this factor? I'm trying to work out the mathematics of this whole thing. What exactly is the plan here? Are we going to see the exact same thing that happened at the AU happen in South Africa and within the ANC, which means effectively nothing? Or are we expecting something to change? I mean, based on her record at the AU, coming into an environment like that, she was ineffective. Most people say that she was good managerially, but it sounds like what ANC needs right now and what South Africa needs right now is a little bit more than a manager. We need an inspirational, charismatic leader that does a little bit more than just make sure that everybody submits their travel claims on time. What's going to happen? What does the scenario look like moving forward with her in the ANC?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I think the answer to that question is that she's been brought in to maintain the power of a certain faction within the ANC, the faction aligned to Jacob Zuma and his compatriots. So I think that's the very short answer to your question. Her job is to maintain that faction's power base and to take it through to 2019.
Let's assume
to win
that
the electoral conference with that faction intact, and to obviously take it through to the election in 2019.
Again, this assumes she's an object. Do you think she doesn't have a mind of her own?
Again, I think she does have a mind of her own. I really do. I mean, I think we need to be relatively careful about how she's been moved around like a pawn. I think she's very, very much involved in this. And she's not a sort of, certainly not unwitting. She's a very, very bright human being. Certainly not unwitting and certainly not unwilling. She's in. She's in all the way. And the fact that she's so intelligent and the fact that she's so willing makes her extremely dangerous, because I think she'll do, I think her anti-democratic instincts are far more severe than anyone has experienced heretofore in South Africa. I think she's, I don't say this lightly, I think she's a dangerous person.
Stephen Hurtis arguably says that she's even more dangerous than Jacob Zuma right now, which is kind of a scary thought to think about.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the content of the stuff that she said over the last little while, she has a severe misunderstanding of how democracy is meant to function, at least taken on the basis of the words that she's spoken out of her mouth. The conflation between the ANC and the government is, quite frankly, even for this country, shocking.
Is she not so smart, as you put it, that she knows that she has to play to the gallery? And the gallery right now are people who want to hear her say those things. What are the chances that then when she assumes power, she would then begin to take ownership? Because she understands that the environment that she's working in is a patriarchal environment. She understands the people working around her. I mean, she was married to the guy for a very long time, and so she knows how to play the game and position herself as subservient, because she needs to achieve whatever she needs to achieve. And then when she gets into power, we see her doing amazing things, maybe not becoming any more interesting than she is, but certainly beginning to use that power to make a change. Is that too much to ask for? Is that like, am I
speaking? Well, I mean, it's certainly possible. Mm. You know, without question, it's possible. But we have to ask ourselves, on what basis do we make that decision? As first of all, as ANC branch members, and second of all, as voters in a general election, we can only take her on the words that she says. Right. I would love to think that she'll come around at some point and embrace the democratic aspect of this country. But based on the words that she said, based on her actions, A, in government, B, in international relations, I have nothing to go by with regard to that fact except hope.
Rich, just let's fast forward a little bit. Two interesting questions that I have and two thoughts that I've just been thinking about as you've been speaking. One is, a lot of people have been speaking about our friend Cristiano Ronaldo 17, and the people supporting him. They seem...
Don't confuse people. What do you mean by Cristiano?
CR17, yes. You know, Cyril Ramaphosa. It's a Real Madrid kind of approach, you know, like big banners with a lot of colors. But I think what I wanted to say was, what's the likeliness, you know, Cyril loses and that actually factionalizes the ANC to the nth degree, where Cyril and a number of key members, including Zweli Mkhize, Gwede Mantashe, actually decide to break away and form their own party. What's the likeliness of that, and how successful do you think they'll be in 2019?
I'm not sure how let's call them loosely call them the constitutionalist faction. I'm not sure how they would be able to exist in ANC that was run by the Zuma faction. I think, first of all, it would be politically impossible. They'd be run out of their position for the most part. And second of all, I think it would be ideologically impossible going forward for them to stay in the ANC. So I think the likelihood of a split, should the Zuma faction maintain power, I think the likelihood of that split is excellent.
That could be very, very interesting. And so just to follow on the train of thought, let's say Dlamini Zuma wins the ANC conference in December, wins the election by, in 2019. What does the relationship look like between South Africa and the rest of the continent, given the poor performance and the poor relations at the AU?
Horrible. The answer to that question is horrible. I think there's several factors that need to be taken in mind. First of all, the downgrading of the rand has a major regional knock-on effect when it comes to the currencies of Botswana, Zimbabwe, Namibia. Don't forget, both the pula and the Namibian dollar pegged to the rand. And of course, Mozambique is in a whole hell of a lot of its own trouble right now. So regionally, the knock-on effect of the downgrade is going to have a major impact, right? And that's going to alienate us from our immediate neighbors more than we are already. In terms of relationships with the rest of the continent, based on the fact that the head of the ANC is Dlamini Zuma, I think you can extrapolate from there by yourself. It would just not be good, like, at all.
Rich, let me challenge you, man. Give us one compliment about her. Just one. Sincere, from the bottom of your heart.
Yeah. I want at least five, because I think the first one's easy. Come on, like, Rory.
You know, listen, she's incredibly bright, and if your hopeful take on this scenario comes right, she's more than capable of being a first of all an excellent manager, no question there, but also I think a great leader. I think she processes and synthesizes information extremely well. I think she were she to stretch herself, she would be a very, very good president. I don't think she's incapable. That's not at all what I'm saying. In fact, I think she's hyper-capable. The issue is what she wants to do and what her intentions are. And that's where it all falls down. In terms of basic, you know, capability, we could do a hell of a lot worse.
Yeah, well, geez, that's a lot to digest. Rich, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be watching this closely, and we might even call you in again to eat your words or to look at you and to marvel at the wisdom that you have shared with us today. It's been quite interesting and quite enlightening. Let's hold on to our seats and see what happens next.
Brilliant, guys. Thanks for having me. Yeah?
Rich, just give us your Twitter handle so people can follow you if they're not already following you.
It's at Poplak, P-O-P-L-A-K.
Right, there you go. Rich Poplak, a journalist in the South African conundrum of journalism. He's at the Daily Maverick, and you can follow him at Twitter, Poplak.
This man's writing is incredibly entertaining.
Excellent.
He starts his one article and he says, like most journos floating turd-like in the increasingly fettered South African press pool, I spent way too much time with Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma of late.
You got to love that. You got to absolutely love that. Rory, we didn't ask how you were feeling, and now it's the end of the show. So going into it, I'm not sure where you were, but I want to hear going out of it where you are.
I'm still forming an opinion.
Don't do that.
I think she's uninspiring. I've heard her speak, and she is incredibly boring. But is that any way to judge a leader? Maybe it is, especially in the times that we are. We need somebody that's going to inspire us, that's going to unite us. She seems visionary if you look at the Agenda 2063 and what she managed to achieve there. But is she able to back that vision with just action and inspiration? So far, not looking good.
What's your feeling on her?
I don't know. She's just somebody.
Give me a feeling.
I don't know. I've stopped feeling. I lost. I don't have a heart, as you know.
That's what politics did to you.
It did that to me. You know that.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much to our guests, Simon Allison and Richard Poplak. Simon is the Mail and Guardian African editor, and Rich Poplak is a journalist at the Daily Maverick, doing amazing things. Check them out. We will be out of here. We'll be checking you again as we follow the road to December 2017. It is going to be super interesting.
Let's get out of here, homie.
Let's get out of here. If you missed any of the podcast, we asked, frankly speaking, is Africa's garbage, South Africa's treasure. Very interesting.
Jovicho.
Jovicho. Ciao, ciao, guys. Have a good day.
CliffCentral.com.